Hey there, welcome to Shoot the Flick. I'm Frankie Sparks.
And I'm Scott Eisenberg.
And we are a married couple who like to shoot the shit about movies.
That we do.
And this week, I have introduced Scotty to yet another Wes Anderson movie. It's been a minute, but the last time we talked about a Wes Anderson movie on this show, we had a special guest with us, and she has done us the great honor of returning. I don't know why, poor thing. She doesn't know what she's getting herself into. But thankfully, we have Claire from the podcast Why the Flick with us again. So happy you're here.
Hi. Yay. I'm super happy to be here, too. Thanks for having me.
So I want to give, before we get into all of the nitty gritty about the Grand Budapest Hotel, released in 2014, I want to give you a chance to promo your stuff, your podcast, because you just started season 4 recently of your podcast.
Yeah, thank you so much. Yeah, so as you mentioned, I have a podcast called Why the Flick. We basically talk about a different movie each episode. I bring on special guests you guys have been on before. I'll tease you guys are going to be on again for season 4, which I'm super excited for. And yeah, we just like talk about all aspects of the movie. We also have some fun segments at the end, so definitely stay until the very end so you can hear those. But yeah, it's a fun time for sure. And you can find us basically wherever you listen to podcasts.
Yes, indeed. But I'm excited to do yours again because we already, I won't spoil it, but we already talked about what we're going to do on your show again. And I'm really excited about it. So be sure to check that out. Okay, so yes, so last time Claire was with us, we talked about Isle of Dogs, which is probably my favorite Wes Anderson movie. It still hangs up there at the number one spot. I would say that this movie is probably like number 2 or 3. Grand Budapest Hotel. It's probably considered to be Wes Anderson's most like generally popular movie to date. It's the most Oscar nominated. So before we get into preliminary fun facts, nitty gritty things, I'm curious opening thoughts from both Scott and Claire. So let's start with our lovely guest. Claire, what did you think about Grand Budapest Hotel?
Yeah, this was actually my first time watching it fully all the way through. Like, I think I'd seen bits and pieces of it, but never from start to finish. And after watching Isle of Dogs, I feel like I knew the tone and I knew the aesthetic of Wes Anderson. So I feel like this movie definitely fit within his typical kind of creative style. I will say when I first watched it, which was just last night, by the end of it, I was like, I liked it, but I feel like it's so exposition heavy because of the way that they framed it with like a story within a story. And it's just like kind of bonkers at parts where I'm just like, you have to kind of, you know, go along with the ride, if you will. But I will say this, I watched it again this morning just because I wanted to have a fresh look at it. And I liked it a lot more on the second watch. I feel like I enjoyed it a lot more. It was funny. And I could definitely like see why a stop motion style like with Isle of Dogs fits his style, because he does do like the staccato movements and the really interesting camera work. So yeah, I really enjoyed it. I thought it was fun.
Yeah, I'll say we talked about Isle of Dogs, but Scotty and I solo have also talked about Moonrise Kingdom, and Grand Budapest actually falls right in between those two movies, which is kind of funny. But yeah, he definitely has a very distinct style, even with Isle of Dogs and with this. And I think with pretty much all of his movies, he has a certain style that you just kind of have to give yourself over to or not. And if you don't fully, then it's just not going to take for you, which I think is probably what happened to Scott a little bit.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe Claire is right. Maybe I do need to watch it a second time fully through to kind of appreciate it more. But just on, because I only watched it this one time, I have seen bits and pieces before, like Claire said, because I remembered the priest going, "Are you Gustavo H?" You know, like, I remember this.
Are you Gustavo from the Grand Budapest? Yes.
I remember that very vividly. But they're like, I don't know. Like, Isle of Dogs, I got. It hooked me in right away. I was like, cool, I get this. I'm down with this. Moonrise Kingdom, I was like, I got this. I'm down. I don't know why this movie didn't grab me in the same way.
It might be what Claire was saying about it being exposition heavy, because it is exposition heavy. It sets up the framing device, which Wes Anderson does have a lot of framing devices in some of his movies, but it takes a while to get into the actual story and then get that going. So maybe that's part of it.
Well, yeah, it's actually like three stories deep, because it's like,
yeah,
the author is telling the story from this man that he heard, and then you go back into his. So it's like a story, yeah, within a story within a story.
Right. It's set up that way to just establish like the timelessness of the story itself, because then by the end, when the story ends, that's how it kind of takes it out. Like, oh, you know, people are always going to be reading about this grand hotel and in the story of the. So it's an effort to add to the grandness of the story. But I get it. It takes a minute to like get there in it.
Yeah.
This movie was nominated for 9 Oscars total, but it won 4 of them. So it won for score, which of course is Alexandre Desplat, because it's Wes Anderson and that's Alexandre Desplat. The only other Oscar he's won is for Shape of Water, which was Guillermo del Toro. So he's a regular for a lot of weird ass filmmakers, which we love. But it also won for makeup and hair, costumes, and production design, which are usually awards that kind of go hand in hand because we're setting up just the vibe of the movie. I think production design in particular is like a big one that obviously this movie was going to win.
Well, yeah, it's built with the fantastical like sets and
yes, it's got. I mean, we got a lot that went into like the making of it. There's miniatures that were used, and then the movie is set in this like fictional Eastern European country, but they filmed it in Germany, and there's a lot of like very stark and standout architecture in Germany just in general. But then the Grand Budapest Hotel itself, which even if you don't know like the movie and haven't seen it, you've seen the poster with the big freaking hotel, and it's very palatial looking. There's a lot of inspiration from Bristol Palace Hotel, very pinkish, but also like a lot of pillars and domed like tower type situation. It's like a whole thing. It's a whole vibe. It was also nominated for editing, but lost to Whiplash, which makes sense. Scott's never seen that, so we got to get on that eventually. But it was also nominated for director, screenplay, cinematography, and best picture, but lost all of them to Birdman, which was a huge movie that year.
Have you seen Birdman, Claire?
No, I was like, have not seen. I know.
That one's good. That one's weird too, but it's good.
Yeah.
I think it also has Edward Norton in it.
Yeah, he got Oscar nominated that. Oh, we're going to talk about Edward Norton.
Well, it's Wes Anderson. Of course, we're going to talk about Edward Norton at some point.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's another staple for Wes Anderson, of course, the ensemble cast. This movie also was nominated for SAG Ensemble, but lost to Birdman. But yeah, it's a lot of Wes Anderson regulars are hanging out in this movie. The only non-regulars, ironically, are the two main leads, but we'll talk about that as we get into it. It made $175 million on its $25 million budget. Big, highest grossing movie of the year. Very highly rated. I was really excited to watch this again because I hadn't seen it in years. But yeah, I was kind of bummed that Scott didn't have the enthusiastic reaction that he had from like Isle of Dogs or even Moonrise Kingdom, where he was like, oh, that was really cool.
Yeah, I thought this was like the Wes Anderson movie. Like his piece de resistance.
Yeah, that's what everyone says.
I think, because I looked at a couple of people's like ratings on like YouTube like really quick before we like started, and this always seemed to be in their like top three.
Yeah.
It was like this, Royal Tenenbaums.
That's another one I got to show you.
Yeah.
Oh, God. I have seen that one. It traumatized me.
I love Royal Tenenbaums. Wes Anderson, even though he does have a very distinct style, it's definitely evolved over the years. You look back at the 90s with like Bottle Rocket and Rushmore. Those are like his first couple of movies. And he has a very like more intimate, I guess, like indie style. And then as he's gotten more mainstream, I guess, it's evolved and gotten bigger scale. Like this is a bigger scale, I would say, Wes Anderson movie. And then you have, of course, have like the animated ones like Isle of Dogs and Fantastic Fox. And now you have movies like French Dispatch and like Asteroid City from last year, which Asteroid City felt like a parody of a Wes Anderson film. Like, it was just so Wes Anderson-y that you didn't even understand what the hell was going on or what they were trying to say. But I feel like this one has a perfect kind of balance of the style and substance, which is what I enjoyed.
I think the thing that I love most about this is Ralph Fiennes. Like, I mean, he's just it absolute for me. And the script is also so witty and smart. So like that also elevates it for me. And stylistically, I think it's really great. And I love the camera work. Like, again, once you like understand the story and where everything's going, on a second watch, I liked it a lot more.
It really is a perfect marriage of like the best parts of Wes Anderson, the editing, the writing, and just the overall ensemble, I think. But yes, Ralph Fiennes definitely stands out. We're going to talk about that. Holy crap. Okay, so are we ready to get into the nitty gritty?
I'm ready.
Let's do it.
All righty. So we open up with our framing device, which we briefly touched on. But we have this author who, the older version of this author is played by Tom Wilkinson, who unfortunately passed away late last year. Do you know who that is, Scott? Like, did you recognize him?
He looked familiar.
He's the villain in Rush Hour.
Oh, okay.
That's why I wrote that down, because I was like, Scott will know him from Rush Hour. But he wrote a book in the 80s about him as a younger man, played by Jude Law, visiting the Grand Budapest Hotel, which was a once grand palatial estate that is now kind of run down, owned by a man named Zero, who the older version of him is played by F. Murray Abraham, again, another Wes Anderson regular. A lot, again, I feel like I shouldn't, I'm not going to mention every single time there's a regular, a Wes Anderson regular in here, because that'll just be like 90% of the things I say. Because everybody in here pretty much is a regular.
Yeah, you got your Owen Wilson, you got your Bill Murray, you got like,
yeah, yeah,
they're all here.
They're all here. And he just tells his sort of rags to riches story. And that's what we get throughout this movie. The story of Zero Mustafa, along with his buddy, his pal, Monsieur Gustave, played by Ralph Fiennes. So our real story begins in 1932. Now we have a young Zero, who is played by Tony Revolori, or as I jokingly call him, Tony Ravioli. This is his feature film debut. He probably is more well known now as Flash from the MCU Spider-Man movies. He is introduced as an illegal refugee escaping a war brought on by this fascist regime. And we find out later that his whole family was slaughtered, basically. And it's actually pretty sad, but the way it comes out later is really like one of the best things in the movie. So I'll save some of that for later. We introduce our main character, really, who is Monsieur Gustave, played by Ralph Fiennes. The role was actually written for him by Wes Anderson. He'd wanted to work with Ralph Fiennes for years, but it just never worked out. And then finally, we had our moment. And Ralph Fiennes, at the time, just got off of Harry Potter. So he was kind of like, I'm sick of playing the villain guy, like, I want to play something else, something fun. And wouldn't you know it, Wes Anderson is here with like probably one of, if not the most quirky, hilarious Wes Anderson characters in his Rolodex.
I am so sorry, is it Ray or Ralph Fiennes? Because now I feel like
said Ralph, but every time I hear an interview, it's Ray, someone, they say Ralph Fiennes, so I'm just going with that. If it's Ralph, I'm sorry, but I feel like either way you're fine.
Apparently Ray is his fictional twin brother, so I feel like that tracks.
Oh my god. But yeah, I love Gustav in this movie. He's got all like the best lines, all the best quirks, all the best character moments.
Absolutely. Yeah, I love like that first. I think the moment I was hooked was when Monsieur Gustav is talking to Tilda Swinton's character. And he's holding her hand and he goes, good God, what is that varnish? And he then says, it's not that I don't like it. It's that I'm physically repulsed. And then it like cuts. And I was like, okay, I'm instantly like in love with this character.
It's so good.
It is good. He's got a lot of good one-liners. I think him and Tony Ravioli. Yes, Tony Ravioli, Ravioli, actually bounce off each other very well. Mm-hmm. It's
the bromance is like the heart of the movie.
It is. It's sometimes the quirk is so quirky.
The quirk is too much.
Like there are just times you sit there and you're like, okay, man. Like I understand Wes, but like, can we tone the quirk down? Like.
Just a bit.
Just a smidge.
How dare you yuck his quirk? Let him be as quirky as possible. I love his quirk. Yeah.
His quirk is not just quirk for quirk's sake.
Yeah.
It's an established character. He has a somewhat mysterious past. We don't know exactly where this guy came from. At one point, Adrian Brody's character, who we'll get to him in a little while, but he calls him a con man, and it's established that he has affairs with several of the older women that are rich and wealthy in this hotel. There are times when he seems just inherently selfish. Like he, at one point, has the potential to come into a lot of money and he says he'll split it with Zero, but the split is like 98% to Zero's 1.5% or something. So there are times when that's more his thing, but then later on as their relationship develops, you see there's like a soft gooey center underneath, it seems, and there is a genuinely compassionate person under all of the quirk.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's the concierge of this hotel, the Grand Budapest Hotel, and Zero shows up there and Gustav eventually hires him as the lobby boy, but he also has a very passionate loyalty and dedication to this hotel and to the customer service-y type vocation that is endearing and also like neurotic almost.
Mm. Yeah, I think like he is exactly as described with the women he likes to sleep with. He's insecure and vain and superficial and needy and blonde.
Yes.
But I do like that we get a little bit more depth to his character over the course of the movie, and I also love how he will continually recite love poetry but always gets like cut off, like he never gets to finish the verse. He's just a little old romantic at heart, and definitely like, what do they say, not before his time but beyond his time.
But yeah, with the love poetry specifically, it gives the impression that like he wants to be this very like almost hoity-toity artistic Romeo type, like, you know, but in reality, when push comes to shove, the street smarts win out in the end, I guess. Mm-hmm. Like he's not really all that he thinks he's cracked up to be.
He's a bit manic, to say the least.
Yeah, sure. But the plot, I guess, of the movie really starts when Tilda Swinton's character, as Claire mentioned, Madame M mysteriously dies. They do a funny bit where like where Zero goes in the morning to get the paper and he shows it to Gustav and there's a big front headline, war breaking out everywhere, and then like this little bottom like square on the right is like, Madame M dies mysteriously, and he's like, oh. Because there's always this undertone throughout the movie of like fascism that's like kind of touched upon, but it's always looming.
Yeah.
As fascists tend to do, I guess.
It's not like central to the story, but it's on the peripheral.
Yeah. So Gustav takes Zero to visit Madame's estate, so go to the reading of the will, and there's a bunch of money-grubbing relatives just waiting in the wings, including her son, who's played by Adrian Brody, Dimitri.
Adrian Brody's a weird actor.
He is. What? That's true. He's a little weird. That's okay, though.
Every movie I've ever seen.
I guess. Yeah.
Every movie I've ever seen of Adrian Brody's, I don't know why. It always takes me a second to be like, do I actually buy you in this role? Like King Kong.
That was the first one I thought of. I was like, I love him. King Kong.
Yeah, no, King Kong. That's fair.
The pianist.
Like, didn't he win an award for that?
He won an Oscar for that. But even still.
Where he creepily made out with Halle Berry when he accepted the award. Yucky. But anyway.
He's just one of those actors that you're like, how did you get to this point in your career?
All right. All right. You know, Scott, considering he's an actor with a distinct and strange nose, I would think you would empathize with him a little bit, but I guess not.
Oh my God. No comment. I'm not participating in this.
No, this is how married people talk to each other. It's fine. Don't. Claire wants to run away. But before we even get to the will reading, there's a thing on the train with Gustav and Zero, which is another scene I really liked, where these soldiers come on the train and they're like checking the paperwork, and Zero has this very crumpled, probably very out of date, if even legal at all, paperwork saying he's a refugee. And Gustav immediately defends him and is like, "Don't fuck with my lobby boy." And I do like that a lot, because at that point, you don't really, they haven't really bonded yet. But his first instinct is to defend him from people trying to fuck with him. And I just really appreciated that.
Service people have to stick together.
Of course. Yeah, that's the thing you get with them too. It's like, even though they're both clearly from different backgrounds and have dealt with different shit, they seem to be alike in the fact that they're kind of alone in the world. And that's what brings them together, I think, ultimately. Which I always like that kind of narrative where you make your own family kind of thing. But, this is where we meet Edward Norton, who plays like the head soldier guy. Because the soldiers also have a running thing throughout the movie where they're just constantly chasing our main characters. And Edward Norton is just being his bumbling old self whenever he's in a Wes Anderson movie. They just relegate him to awkward bumbling guy.
Well, we can't buy him as the same guy from Fight Club anymore, so bumbling works.
That's true. That was like 15 years ago, so we can't do that anymore.
He literally looked like it was the same character as Isle of Dogs. Like that.
Oh yeah.
You can't convince me otherwise. Like even his movements, I was like, "You're that dog. I recognize you."
Yeah.
Well, yeah. He's the dog from Isle of Dogs. He's the Boy Scout troop leader from Moonrise Kingdom.
Yeah, they're all the same.
Also a bumbling idiot.
All the same thing. That seems to be the Wes Anderson hole that he's gotten himself in. Which is funny, because when we talked about Edward Norton in the Hulk movie, like when he was talking about like, oh, you know, this script is shit, I want to write a real movie. And then the same year he was in Birdman, which is like considered a more like serious, like Oscar-y movie, not really as palatable for general audiences. So he really kind of toes that line between complete joke in Hollywood, I feel like, and actual like serious actor. Like no one really knows what to expect from him.
Yeah, I've been reading this Marvel Cinematic Universe book that's like going through all of the history, and I read the Incredible Hulk chapter, and he did not come off very flattering after I read that chapter. And so now I feel like I have a very like altered perception of him. I have no idea who he is as a person, so I can't say one way or the other how he is on set, but he seems very controlling over like what kind of art that he gets portrayed in.
I think it's taken him a while to kind of get over that perception.
Well, I think Wes Anderson has only helped him in that regard.
Well, good.
Because if you're playing bumbling idiots all the time, you're not really, it's kind of disarming. But mind you don't get Oscar nominations. Because Birdman, he played an asshole. I haven't seen Birdman probably since it came out, but I remember Edward Norton's character was a big ol' asshole. So, I don't know. Toe in the line.
Yeah.
But, so we get to the reading of the will, and we meet Madame's lawyer, Kovacs, played by Jeff Goldblum. We've, of course, talked about Jeff Goldblum before, because why wouldn't you? We talked about him in The Fly. He was in Thor Ragnarok. I feel like it's like an obvious marriage with Jeff Goldblum and Wes Anderson, because they're both so weird and quirky.
But I love him all the same.
The thing is, I don't feel like he's quirky in this. Like
his quirkiness in this is like subdued a little bit.
Like it feels like if you took this character and his apartments.com guy.
Not apartments.com.
It feels like the similar character. Like it's not full Goldblum. It's not like,
well, he's
Ian
playing
Malcolm,
a lawyer.
But it's not like Ian Malcolm or him in The Fly, kind of like where he's Goldblum.
Yeah, he's not at full Goldblum capacity. I'll say that.
Yeah. Even at 1% Goldblum, I'm still like sold.
Yeah. I mean, the whole scene, there's one scene in this movie where Dimitri is like in his office and he's got like this lackey played by Willem Dafoe, which we'll talk about. And Willem Dafoe is just holding Jeff Goldblum's cat and they get pissed off at him. So Willem Dafoe throws his cat out the window and Jeff Goldblum is just like, huh? Like what?
Did you just throw my cat out the window?
It was so like that was probably the best bit. And then later on you see him like they pan back like from far away and you see Jeff Goldblum throw a bag that's clearly filled with a dead cat in the garbage. It's just yeah, like, oh god,
that was under the coat check. He like pulled out the card and it said deceased Persian cat and he had to pick it up from the coat check lady. Also I have a conspiracy now that Wes Anderson hates cats because he killed a cat in this movie and Isle of Dogs the cats were evil. So Wes Anderson, I'm on to you.
Okay, so yes, we get to the reading of the will and Goldblum announces that Gustav has been bequeathed this Renaissance painting called Boy with Apple and it's supposedly very very expensive and fancy, and Dimitri of course flips his shit and he's like no. And there's this really great scene where they all just punch each other in the face. Like Dimitri punches Gustav because he says if I find out you've had your hands on my mother I'll kill you. And Gustav is just like, well, I go to bed with all of my friends. Bam. And then
Zero punches him in the face.
Yeah, Zero punches him and then Willem Dafoe punches Zero. So everyone's bleeding.
Everyone always seems to have like a bloody nose constantly in this movie.
Yeah, it's just like one like run of blood under their nostril.
Yeah.
But yeah, they're like, no, 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 you're not getting this painting. Fuck you. So Gustav and Zero decide they're just going to steal it. And with the help of the staff, get the painting wrapped up and get it out, and they ended up hiding it in a safe at the Grand Budapest Hotel.
Can we just mention the painting they replace it with?
Oh my god. they replaced it with a very sexually explicit painting, which is funny.
Well, it's funny because like it's even funnier because Adrian Brody doesn't know this for like,
oh
for
my god, like, yeah,
90% of the movie.
Yeah, I looked on IMDb and the painting is called Two Lesbians Masturbating. That's its official name. And that, yeah, love that. Yeah, I was so heartbroken when Adrian Brody destroyed it. I was like, god.
But also, it's worth mentioning that the painting itself, Boy with Apple, was commissioned by Wes Anderson by an award-winning English painter by the name of Michael Taylor. And it was done specifically for the film. It's like the most foppish, like old, boring looking, like old painting. And it's so innocuous. It's literally just a guy in like Victorian clothing holding an apple. And this painting is like this MacGuffin for this whole movie.
Yeah, he's like, I'm gonna die with this above my bed. I'll never get rid of it.
2 seconds and then, later, yeah. Let's just sell it.
Actually, we should probably sell it because they're gonna come after us.
Oh my god, it is funny. Oh, but then we kind of also, when they're talking about selling the painting, because Zero is like, do you think maybe I could get like, I don't know, 10% instead of 1.5%? And he's like, no, you fool. But you could be my sole heir when I die. So when I die, everything I have goes to you. And it's like, aw, but also, fuck you.
like, not everything. What I don't spend on whiskey and women will come to you.
He says we. What we don't spend on whiskey and women, yes.
I was going to ask, can we mention just how Willem Dafoe is channeled the goblin for this particular movie?
Oh my god.
So hard.
It's so funny, too, because like Adrian Brody and Willem Dafoe both look like they're channeling the Crow. In their aesthetic. Ooh. But then yes, Willem Dafoe especially, he's got like eye makeup on and he just looked generally
menacing,
sickly his and teeth, menacing. Yes,
his teeth really stood out for me, like his two bottom canines were always protruding, no other teeth, just his two bottom canines, like a dog.
Well, at this point, I mean, you gotta think of it too, because Willem Dafoe is like, even in 2014, which is obviously 10 years ago, he's still like a huge fucking star. And this role of Jopling, I think the guy's name is, which that's not a name. It could be considered like a cameo. He's in it so little, but he makes such an impact. And it's like the fact that he wanted to be in this movie, considering how small the role was, probably says a lot about just him as an artist, but also Wes Anderson. It's like, yeah, no, I'll be in the Wes Anderson movie, whatever you want.
I just love how Wes Anderson has amassed this like gaggle of weirdos who will go do a movie anytime. And I love the weirdos.
That's also a thing with other ones too. Like Jason Schwartzman is usually, and even Owen Wilson too, they were so very much involved. Like they both, I think, got their start with like the early Wes Anderson movies.
Well, yeah, Owen Wilson's the star of the first one,
Bottle Rocket. And then Schwartzman is Rushmore. And like they in other movies also in his filmography, more recent ones, they have huge roles. But even in movies like this where Owen Wilson's in it for like 5 minutes, Jason Schwartzman, same thing. But they still are just like, yeah, whatever, man, whatever you need. I'm there. Like, I love that. And it really is like a ragtag group of weirdos, like you said, Claire. It's very we're all in this together type thing.
I hope they all have like a group chat that they just like riff.
Oh my God, imagine.
Wes just types in, hey guys, I have another idea for a movie. Owen, I need you to be a dog who stares out the window. And Owen's like, I'm down.
You're like, okay, where do you need me? So right after they abscond with this painting and they're back at the hotel, Edward Norton shows up with a gaggle of troops to arrest Gustav. And they do a quick little like funny bit where they go and greet the police. And Gustav's like, ah, yes. Hello, Mr. Henkels. That's fucking, all the names are weird. Henkels, yeah. From fucking Edward Norton. He's like, oh, hello there. Yes, let's have a talk, shall we? And then he just jets down the hallway.
Miss Madame M was murdered. And he goes, oh, and you think I did it?
Got it, yeah. Sure, fine. Run. So Gustav is promptly arrested and thrown in jail, and he quickly befriends this gang led by Harvey Keitel in another very small cameo-sized role for a Wes Anderson movie, which he had in both Moonrise Kingdom and Isle of Dogs.
I think Harvey Keitel prefers it this way. The roles you remember Harvey Keitel for... these Wes Anderson roles, The Wolf,
National Treasure.
We remember like these smaller little roles where he just kind of pops up. He's like, hi, and like leaves.
Oh, God. But yeah, like our first introduction to him, he's like shirtless.
Oh, my God.
In the jail cell. He's like super buff with tattoos all over him. You don't even like fully recognize him from the neck down until you like see his face. You're like, oh, that's Harvey Keitel. Holy shit.
I kept thinking it was Alan Arkin. I was like... I was like, that looks like Alan Arkin. I was like, no.
He does look a little like Alan Arkin with the shaved head.
Yeah. No. I get where you're coming from there. That is funny, though. But this prison gang is planning an escape through the sewers.
It's also funny because Gustav is in this prison. And Gustav is like the trolley boy. Like, oh, would you like some food? Like, he gives this giant guy with a scar, on, his
scar
face.
On his face.
He gives him slop and the guy's like,
yeah, and he's just so nice to him.
Because he put salt in it.
Yeah.
Just a little salt.
Made it taste a little bit better.
But it comes back later, because when they escape, the big guy with the scarred face helps them escape. And and Gustav is just like, oh, thank you, kind, sweet man.
Yeah.
He's like the scariest looking person on planet Earth.
One of my favorite moments is also when they pass the layout of the prison to Gustav, and he goes, who drew this? And the guy goes, I did. And he goes, this is so good. This shows great artistic promise. Like, he's so supportive.
I feel like that's what makes his character so intriguing and interesting, because, like, he does have this mysterious element to him. And you don't really know, like, how he ended up here. But he just has such, like, a perfect way of being incredibly kind to people that it's like, oh, you're so nice.
He just, like... says the thing that you're not expecting. So I feel like he's always keeping you on your toes.
Yes.
Here with like Harvey Keitel's gang, it's just so funny because you have all these horrible people who are like in prison. And it's like, because of Wes Anderson's quirk and Gustav, you're like, oh, these are good people. Well, you're cool with that.
Because there's a specific line that Gustav says earlier in the movie when he's being his concierge self. Because obviously when you run a hotel, I'm sure, you know, with a bunch of rich people, you run into some a-holes. So basically what Gustav's policy is, what his mantra is, that even the meanest person can open up like a flower when you're kind to them, because the root of rudeness is fear. Fear that you won't get what you want. So all you have to do is be kind and then they will be not rude, which as someone who's worked in retail, I can assure you that's not true.
Yeah.
But it's a nice thought.
That's why we say kill them with kindness. As someone who was both in restaurant and in retail, it doesn't work out that way.
No, no. Maybe sometimes, but usually no. Oh, so this is where we get the introduction of Agatha, because the gang is like, we need tools to help us dig and escape and, you know, hammers and chisels and things. And he enlists Zero, who at this time has a girlfriend named Agatha who works in a bakery, a very, very well-known local bakery that's like really, really good, and they make pastries, and Agatha puts little tools, little hammers and things into pastries and sends them to the prison. And the guy, apparently the person that's supposed to check for contraband, just can't bring himself to break open the pastries because they're so pretty. So like, they successfully smuggle weapons and chisels into the prison to help their escape. But I do want to mention Agatha because she's played by I can never say her name. Saoirse Ronan. This is 5 years before Little Women. So this is still like before she's really big. But she's great and I love her. And in this movie particularly, I really like her because she's just there to be like awesome and cool and love on Tony Ravioli. And she has a big birthmark on the side of her face, which I like that aspect of her character, because Gustav mentions at one point, like, even though she works like a dog at that bakery and is treated like shit by the head baker guy, and she's got this huge birthmark on her face that most people would probably, like, you know, never want to leave the house, she's just so lovely and wonderful, and she's cool.
I honestly think she's great in the movie. It's just the very end of the movie that kind of bums me out.
Oh, yeah, we'll get to that.
Yeah.
I think that kind of hurts the overall feeling of the movie for me at the end.
I can understand that, because I kind of felt that too watching it this time around. I like forgot that the end happened. So when it happened again and I saw it, I was like, oh, well, I guess the movie's over now. We'll talk about it. But yeah, it's kind of a bummer.
I knew something tragic or sad had to have happened because F. Murray Abraham was having such a difficult time bringing her up and talking about her. So I knew like eventually something bad was going to happen, but I really love Saoirse Ronan, and we only get like a little brief look inside the romance between Zero and Agatha, but it works for me because the way that he signs his notes to her, it's from Z to A, and I find that incredibly romantic.
Yeah, I thought like they're very cute.
Oh, that was smooth as hell.
They're very cute.
That was good. That was good.
I even like there's one scene where they kind of have like an argument, because at one point he tries to give her like a secret code or whatever to tell her where the painting is in case anything happens to him. And she's just like, no, Zero, I'm not an art smuggler. I'm not going to be a part of this. And then he goes to leave and he's just like, take it. And she's like, no. And he's like, take it anyway. And then leaves.
And I love that she gets to speak in her Irish accent, because there's so often that we don't get to hear that. And I love an Irish accent. So it was nice.
Before we get Gustav actually escaping, we also get Dimitri is pissed off and trying to find Gustav and trying to find the painting. So he sends Willem Dafoe to kill the lawyer. He kills Jeff Goldblum. We have to talk about Jeff Goldblum's untimely demise.
So sad. I was really hoping he'd make it, but as soon as he was being tailed, I was like, I don't see poor Kovac surviving this.
Yeah, because Kovac's this is the scene where his cat gets thrown out the window.
Yeah.
But before that, Kovac's is like, yeah, I work for the dead lady because I'm running her estate. I don't work for you, so fuck off. And to me, she's like,
I'm so glad that he stood up for himself. Like, I'm so glad that he stood his ground, even though it did get him killed in the end.
So what happens is, I have to give Jeff Goldblum credit here. He does a really good job showing fear. I know that sounds funny, but being a guy who has watched so many horror movies,
yeah,
and seen so many chase scenes, there are a lot of times you're like, okay, come on, I get it. You're an actress being chased by a monster. I get it. But he sells it here. Like, he sells that he is afraid of this guy.
Yeah. I was really terrified. Even though, like, the music's like, it's still, like, really scary the way that William Dafoe chases him throughout this museum.
Yeah, and then later on, it's kind of, like, wrapped up perfectly. Henkels is looking for Gustav, and Willem Dafoe is just there being a creep. He goes to Willem Dafoe, and he's like, hey, we found that lawyer guy, Kovacs, and he was missing four fingers.
Oh, my God.
And he was, like, in a sarcophagus. You know anything about that?
The jump scare of his fingers getting cut off, like,
Jesus. Woof.
I was like, on the edge of my seat waiting, because I knew he wasn't going to make it last minute. But I was not expecting his fingers to get cut off by the door. That was rough.
Yeah. But then they also do, like, a fake-out kill with Agatha. Because they have a little thing with Agatha, and then right after that, they talk about a girl was found with her head in a basket. And it actually ends up being Madame M's butler's sister, because the butler escapes at one point. He runs away. Mm-hmm. And we're going to talk about him in a minute. Yeah. But they build it up, and I was waiting for Scott to, like, have some kind of reaction to, like, this poor innocent girl being beheaded. And he did. He was like, wait, did they actually kill her? And I'm like, yeah, you know, it's a shame. And then lo and behold, it's not her. And you're like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, like Claire said earlier, like, I expected something bad to happen to Agatha. So I thought this was the bad thing that was going to happen Agatha.
No, it makes sense. Yeah.
It would have been Saoirse Ronan's head, and then we would have had Brad Pitt cameo and go, what's in the box?
I was just going to say.
One of my notes was, what's in the box?
Yeah, the escape bit, I think, is really fun and, like, crazy, because, like, the bad guys who are now free go, like, kill a guy on the bus, to steal his bus and drive away in the background.
Yeah.
While Gustav and Zero.
Oh, my God. Yeah, Zero and Gustav are reunited. And this is, like, probably one of my favorite scenes in the movie. Because Gustav is like, didn't you bring my cologne? Like, what's wrong with you? You didn't find a safe house? What have you been doing? And he, like, goes off on him. And then Gustav is like, why did you even come to this country in the first place? And Tony Ravioli is just like, because of the war and stuff. And then he has this, like, really serious moment where he's like, yeah, they killed my whole family and I had to come here. And then Gustav just completely has, like, a breakdown and just feels so terrible. He's like, I'm so sorry. I apologize on behalf of the hotel. When he said, I apologize on behalf of the hotel, I died. It's like,
I love this moment because it's like we can see Gustav's ignorance really coming out in this moment, and the things that he's focused on are so inconsequential to, like, what Zero has gone through. Like, I do appreciate that Gustav was, like, at that moment realizing, like, oh, I'm a fucking idiot, I'm truly sorry, please forgive me. And he's, like, spiraling, and Zero's like, just let's forget about it, it's fine, and move on.
You were upset because I didn't bring your cologne. Okay.
Yeah.
I do like their relationship, though, because at one point Zero says they're brothers, and I feel like that makes sense to me.
That felt right in that moment. I'm glad that they, and even, like, later Saoirse Ronan's reciting poetry, she calls them celestial brothers, and I really like that too.
I feel like they really are, like, the heart of the movie. They both have obviously great jokes and stuff, mostly Gustav, but even between the two of them, they both have good moments separately, but together they have a really good chemistry.
They do. They have great chemistry. But the moment that it's right after this, where Ed Norton comes out of the hole in the ground and gives Wes Anderson's version of the fugitive speech.
Oh, yeah. He's like, I want to search every doghouse and house. But yeah, Gustav is like, no, I would apologize to you more, but we have to go now. We have to run. That's the alarm. So we'll have to go. So then they run off and they have nowhere to go. So Gustav finds a phone booth and calls up the Society of the Crossed Keys, which is a secret society of hotel concierge. And we get a who's who of Wes Anderson regulars here. We get Bill Murray, of course. We get Bob Balaban, Fisher Stevens. Everybody comes together to help out fellow concierge. Mm-hmm. And they basically orchestrate a secret meeting between Gustav and Zero and the runaway butler, whose name is Serge, who has some information that might help clear Gustav's name. So this is where we get the annoying scene that Scott was referring to earlier, where he was getting aggravated because they kept asking Gustav.
Are you Monsieur Gustav of the Grand Budapest Hotel in Naples, Bart? Uh-huh. Switch with me.
Put this robe on and sing.
Confess.
Confess it. I'm innocent.
I love that there's a group out there that exists that if you ever need a last minute opera ticket or the restaurant corner table on a Thursday, group has you covered.
It was a very Wes Anderson edition because it's like this random thing that it's very lofty and important, but doesn't really matter. Like, why does this exist?
The succession of everyone getting interrupted, doing something and saying to someone else, take over. Yeah, one guy's singing like happy birthday to kids and another one's like giving CPR to a dying man and he's like, take over. I've got more important things to do.
So we get a little meeting with Serge in the confessional at the church. And Serge reveals that he was pressured to implicate Gustav in Madame's murder by Dimitri, who is the real murderer, which is shocking to no one. But apparently Madame had a secret second will hidden away somewhere that would go into effect if she had been murdered. No one can find this secret will, but unfortunately, before any more information can be shared, Willem Dafoe arrives and kills Serge and tries to flee, but Gustav and Zero chase after him in this very high octane, fucking wacky ass miniature / CGI fucking ski chase on a snowy ass mountain.
This is fucking hilarious. This was my favorite. I think this is probably like the scene that I know most of is this moment in the movie when they're on the sled and the skis. And I love the moment when Zero is like, what are we going to do when we catch him? And Gustav is like, I don't know. He's a homicidal psychopath. Let's leave.
Wait, I can't turn around. But yeah, like it really is like just completely separated from the movie. If you asked Wes Anderson to do like a car chase scene in an action movie, like this is what you would get.
I love it.
It's like so weird and very uniquely done with like they do have a miniature version of the forest and then you go in and it's like they end up like crashing by this cliff and Gustav is hanging over the side reciting poetry like I'm gonna die, oh sweet world. And fucking Willem Dafoe is just standing over him looming creepily, and then right as like the pinnacle of the poem hits, Zero just throws his ass off the cliff.
He gets yeeted off that cliff. Oh my god, it was so good.
It was really funny. And then Gustav's like, damn, you got him. Okay, cool.
Yeah.
And Norrin from the distance going, don't move.
Oh, yeah, that'll work out. That was so stupid. God damn it, yeah. Edward Norton.
I honestly want to know, just from any police officer, how often does yelling from a distance
don't move
actually work?
So we get Zero and Gustav escaping, and we get to like I guess what's considered the traditional climax of the movie, although I would consider the snowy ski chase to be much more exciting than what's about to happen. But basically they go back to the hotel, the Grand Budapest Hotel, and it's been essentially warped into this like fascist headquarters, and Dimitri's there. Owen Wilson is the concierge for literally 2 seconds, and you're just like, oh, I want you to stay longer.
I know.
He's so good. I love him. Ever since Loki came out, I feel like I've grown a new appreciation for Owen Wilson, and I'm just like, damn, man. He can make you feel things and also make you laugh awkwardly. So they enlist Agatha to kind of sneak into the hotel disguised as like a bakery delivery person. And they're like, hey, you want some delicious pastries? Let me sneak in there and get the painting out of the safe. But she's caught by Dimitri. And when the guys go in to try to save her, fucking shootout breaks out. It's just like, whoa, what movie are we in? Hold on.
Okay. Adrian Brody's, I think his best moment is in this part of the movie.
Sure. He's giving full crow now.
Well, not even that. Just not even the full crow thing, but he's following Saoirse Ronan at like a pace, and she turns and he's like, oh yeah, I'll catch up to her easy. And she starts sprinting.
She's running. And I'm like, yes, good girl.
And he's like, God damn it.
Oh my God. That was my favorite moment too with him.
And then he sees Gustav across the way. He's like, where's boy with apple? And Gustav's just like, none of your fucking business. Yeah. They're just so mad. It's like, dude, it's a fucking ugly ass painting. Like,
I know. Like, they're still trying to find it. Like, there's so many other factors happening here with the mom being mysteriously murdered, but everyone is still fucking obsessed with this stupid painting.
Yeah, it's a lot of elements, a lot of moving parts. But the shootout starts, and then all of a sudden, Edward Norton shows up to solve everything, and you're just like, oh, you're gonna fix this? Okay. And then Agatha somehow went out the window and she's hanging off the side of the fucking building, and Zero's like, hold on, I'm coming.
Oh my God, yeah.
And they end up falling ever so gracefully in a truck full of pastries, which is cute.
Who knew landing in a thing of pastries would break your fall from 2 stories up?
I mean,
who knew?
It's fine. Sure, movie magic.
Yeah, suspend your disbelief.
I need the Mythbusters episode
about if you fell from a 2-story window into a box of
how much cake would break your fall?
How much cake would save your life and keep you from breaking your back?
Oh my God.
Jesus. Well, they are very fluffy pastries.
Yeah, by all accounts. Those pastries look goddamn good. I want one.
They were really like baking them, I think, because they wanted it to look real. So
I think Wes,
all the pastries were real.
I think Wes Anderson, because I read this somewhere, he made Saoirse Ronan like learn actually how to bake.
Yeah, love that.
So she actually baked all the pastries,
which is very cool.
Because he's like, the pastries play such an important role in the movie. You have to learn to actually bake them.
I mean, yeah. If Saoirse Ronan was like, would you like a pastry that I make myself? I'd be like, yes, please. But so she, while she's hanging off the building with the painting, sees that in the bottom of it, there's the secret will. So they find the secret second will. And it says that Gustav gets literally everything, including Boy with Apple and the Grand Budapest Hotel, because turns out she was actually the secret owner of the Grand Budapest Hotel. So Gustav gets everything. He gets exonerated of her murder. Dimitri flees the country. And I like how they kind of framed it at the end, where Gustav becomes the very thing that he was having affairs with at the beginning of the movie. He becomes insecure, vain, and very, very rich.
Yes.
And blonde.
But he never got old, though.
Yeah, so he actually married Agatha and Zira, which was very sweet. And then they show sometime later they're on a train together. And these, once again, fascist assholes come in and fuck with Zira. And I just thought that scene was so sad, because they literally knock Zira unconscious. And then they grab Gustav. Mm. And it's said later by older Zira that he was shot and killed.
He died defending his brother.
Which is like a very good ending for Gustav, but also like, fuck man, he was a good character.
And then we also add to the fact that Agatha, it was Agatha all along.
Oh no.
I had to do it once this episode.
Fine, you get one.
That's I get fair. One.
Did you get it out of your system?
Yes, good now. But Agatha apparently like
They had a child, and
they had a child, and they both died like 2 years later.
Yeah,
and I'm like, well,
it's very like bummer. It's very hastily ended the story in that way. Like they're just like, yes, I kept the hotel from my wife, because obviously when Gustav dies, everything goes to zero. So Zero's like, yes, I kept the hotel from my lovely wife Agatha, because she died 2 years after this, and we had some great times in this hotel, but she died of disease with my son. And it's like, holy shit, okay.
Boy, that escalated quickly. I mean, that really got out of hand fast.
But, yeah, the story ends quite abruptly in that way. I don't know if I love the way that they ended it. Because it basically ends with us finding out that Agatha is long dead, and that Zero lived pretty much his whole life alone, just in this hotel that's been slowly crumbling over the years.
Well, we do get that line that Gustav had said in the beginning in the train car, and it comes back around at the end when Mustafa was saying,
"There are still faint glimmers of civilization left in this barbaric slaughterhouse that was once known as humanity. He was one of them."
I like that tie-in, that circled back around too.
And that's the Grand Budapest Hotel, guys. So, yeah. Yay. I really enjoyed watching this again. It was a nice blast from the past. I rated it a 4 out of 5 stars. How did you guys rate it star-wise? I'm curious.
On Letterboxd, I would give it like a 4 out of 5 too. I think I'd actually go maybe a little bit higher if I could, like maybe 4.4, not quite 4.5 for me, but I enjoyed it. I liked it a lot more on the second watch. I found it to be really funny. I caught on to a lot more things that were happening, because I feel like in the beginning, you're just, it like bounces so much. And I think a lot of that's due to like the script, the witty script and the sharp camera work. So I'm like, I'm just trying to like keep up and be like, okay, this happened. So the second time around, I knew where we were going. So I could, I think, enjoy it a little bit more. But the cast is incredible. Like, as always, Ralph Fiennes, whoever you are, is remarkable. Most of like his dialogue was my favorite part of the entire movie.
Yeah.
Second being Jeff Goldblum, because I love him so much.
We love Jeff Goldblum.
Yeah. But yeah, production design, amazing. Like the way that they use, like the hotel itself is so beautiful they finally go back to the 1930s. And like the pulley system of like even like getting up the mountain to go to it is so cool. Like I want to go to that hotel. If it ever existed in real life, it'd be cool. But yeah, I thought it was a fun story. There's something for everyone to enjoy. And yeah, I'm glad I watched it.
I'm gonna be the low man on the totem pole here.
It's okay. If you didn't like this one as much as the other one, that's okay.
Yeah, like I still liked it. I think I do have to watch it again. Because even talking about it, there's more I liked about it that we talked about.
Mm-hmm.
Like right now I have it as a free on Letterboxd. I was kind of leaning like I would want it to be like a 3.25. And now I'm kind of leaning at a 3.5.
Okay.
You're getting there.
I'm getting there. It's a good movie. It's fun. There's some wonky stuff. There's some quirk. Again, we've said this before. Wes Anderson ain't for everybody. He's not.
That's true. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And even if you like Wes Anderson, some Wes Anderson isn't going to be for people who like Wes Anderson.
That's true.
I don't think I could only watch Wes Anderson. I think I'd get a bit tired of it. I think it's good to like give yourself some distance in between these movies so that you can be like, oh yeah.
I think Wes Anderson needs to give himself some distance from Wes Anderson for a while, because the last two movies were like, Jesus, man, we get it. Like,
I do really want to see Asteroid City though after watching this one.
I was really looking forward to it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was sadly disappointed, but maybe I'll try it again and see. But it just felt like it was trying to be like an older school Wes Anderson, where it's like quirky and weird, and like it looks very bright and colorful and meticulously produced, and then it was just missing like the heart. Like there was no heart. This has a lot of heart, I feel like, underneath all of the meticulousness, as does like something like Isle of Dogs or Moonrise Kingdom. But Asteroid City just felt hollow to me. Felt like we were going through the motions. Okay, so I feel like we've had yet another successful Wes Anderson viewing.
Indeed.
Agreed.
I know Claire has seen this one already, but I definitely want to show you Royal Tenenbaums. That's been on my list for you for a long time. Would you be open to watching another Wes Anderson?
I'll watch another Wes Anderson.
Okay, cool. We'll keep that in mind for the future. So before we say our goodbyes, I want to thank the dear Claire for showing up once again with our craziness and talking about this movie. Perhaps next time you come on this show, we'll shake it up a little bit and we'll do something else that's not Wes Anderson. But I want to give you another shot to promo all your stuff and say goodbyes before we head out.
Well, thank you. I always have a blast coming on and talking about, well, Wes Anderson movies with you. So anytime you want to talk about Wes Anderson or another movie, I am down. But yeah, as I mentioned, my podcast is called Why the Flick. We talk about a new movie each episode and ask ourselves, why the flick did we watch this? And I have a different guest on every episode. So as I also mentioned, just started season 4. So we've got new episodes coming out bi-weekly. You guys will be on very soon. So you can find us wherever you listen to podcasts. And then if you would like to follow us on social, we are at Why the Flick on Instagram, TikTok, Twitter, and Letterboxd. So definitely check us out there.
Yes, please do. And we are off next week here at Shoot the Flick, but the week after that, we're going to have quite an interesting time because you know how every year we've done a Rocky movie? Well, I'm kind of sick of that. So I'm like, let's just watch all the rest of the Rocky movies in one foul swoop. So April is literally going to be just all Rocky movies. So if you don't like Rocky, you might want to take a break from us for a little bit. But until then, this has been Shoot the Flick. I'm Frankie Sparks.
And I am Mr. Scott.
You didn't even say Monsieur right.
Okay.
make sure you check us out on Instagram and Twitter at Shoot the Flick and check out all of our episodes on iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and iHeartRadio, and pretty much anywhere else you can find a podcast. And make sure you come back in 2 weeks for our Jesus Christ. What do we call this, Scott?
Rocky month.
For our Rocky is right. Rocky ass. Crazy ass movie adventure
from Z to A.
Okay.
Aww.
My house in Budapest, my hidden treasure chest, golden grand piano, my beauty focus, Neo, you. Ooh, you. Ooh, I'd leave you.